Geryon was so caught up in the world that had just opened to him that he did not see the two silvery-haired men at first. They stood together beneath a tall tree, waiting as the party rode nearer. They wore identical blue robes, and their white hair was quite long, though they were clean-shaven. When Geryon looked at them for the first time, he thought for a moment that his eyes were playing tricks. The two were so absolutely identical that it was impossible to tell them apart.
"Belgarath, our brother," one of them said. "It has been such a terribly long time,"
the other finished.
"Belgira," Belgarath said. "Belkira."
He dismounted and embraced the twins.
"Dearest little Palgara," one of them said then.
"The veil has been,"
the other started.
"Empty without you,"
the second completed. He turned to his brother.
"That was very poetic," he said admiringly.
"Thank you,"
the first replied modestly.
"These are my brothers, Belgira and Belkira,"
Belgarath informed the members of the party who had begun to dismount.
"Don't bother to try to keep them separate. Nobody can tell them apart anyway."
"We can," the two said in unison.
"I am not even sure of that," Belgarath responded with a gentle smile. "Your minds are so close together that your thoughts start with one and finish with the other."
"You have always complicated it so much, father,"
Aunt Paul said.
"This is Belgira."
She kissed one of the sweet-faced old men.
"And this is Belkira."
She kissed the other.
"I have been able to tell them apart since I was a child."
"Belgira knows all our secrets,"
the twins smiled.
"And who are your companions?"
"I think you'll recognize them," Belgarath answered. "Mandoran, Baron of Omandor."
"The Night Protector,"
the twins said in unison, bowing.
"Prince Keldar of Dresnia."
"Ah, the guide,"
they said.
"Merrick, Earl of Trelheim."
"The Dreadful Bear."
They looked at the big Kerrick apprehensively.
Merrick's face darkened, but he said nothing. "Hesar, son of Kohag of Algeria."
"Ah, the Horse Lord."
"And Durnik of Sundaria."
"The one with two lives,"
they murmured with profound respect. Durnik looked baffled at that.
"Chenedra, Imperial Princess of Tunedra."
"Our Queen of the World,"
they replied with another deep bow. Chenedra laughed nervously.
"And this can only be Belgarion,"
they said, their faces alive with joy.
"The Chosen One."
The twins reached out in unison and laid their right hands on Geryon's head. Their voices sounded within his mind.
"Hail, Belgarion, overlord and champion, hope of the world."
Geryon was too surprised at this strange benediction to do more than awkwardly nod his head.
"If this gets any more cloying, I think I'll vomit,"
a new voice, harsh and rasping, announced. The speaker, who had just stepped out from behind the tree, was a squat, misshapen old man, dirty and profoundly ugly. His legs were bowed and gnarled like oak trunks. His shoulders were huge, and his hands dangled below his knees. There was a large hump in the middle of his back, and his face was twisted into a grotesque caricature of a human countenance. His straggly iron-gray hair and beard were matted, and the twigs and bits of leaves were caught in the tangles. His hideous face wore an expression of perpetual contempt and anger.
"Beldin," Belgarath said mildly, "we weren't sure you would come."
"Yes, I shouldn't have, you bungler,"
the ugly man snapped. "You've made a mess of things as usual, Belgarath."
He turned toward the twins.
"Get me something to eat,"
he told them peremptorily.
"Yes, Belden,"
they said quickly, and started away.
"And don't be all day about it,"
he shouted after them.
"You seem to be in a good humor today, Belden," Belgareth said, with no trace of sarcasm. "What's made you so cheerful?"
The ugly dwarf scowled at him, then laughed a short, barking sound.
"I saw Belzedar. He looked like an unmade bed. Something had gone terribly wrong for him, and I enjoy that sort of thing."
"Dear Uncle Belden,"
Aunt Paul said fondly, putting her arms around the filthy little man,
"I have missed you so much."
"Don't try to charm me, Palgara,"
he told her, though his eyes seemed to soften slightly.
"This is as much your fault as it is your father's. I thought you were going to keep an eye on him. How did Belzedar get his hands on our master's orb?"
"We think he has used a child," Belgareth answered seriously. "The orb will not strike an innocent."
The dwarf snorted.
"There's no such thing as an innocent. All men are born corrupt."
He turned his eyes back to Aunt Paul and looked appraisingly at her.
"You're getting fat," he said bluntly. "Your hips are as wide as an ox cart."
Durnick immediately clenched his fists and went for the hideous little man. The dwarf laughed, and one of his big hands caught the front of the smith's tunic. Without any seeming effort, he lifted the surprised Durnick and threw him several yards away.
"You can start your second life right now, if you want," he growled threateningly.
"Let me handle this, Durnick," Aunt Paul told the smith. "Belden," she said coolly, "how long has it been since you've had a bath?"
The dwarf shrugged.
"Rained on me a couple of months ago."
"Not hard enough, though. You smell like an uncleaned pigsty."
Belden grinned at her.
"That's my girl. I was afraid the years had taken off your edge," he chortled.
The two of them then began to trade the most hair-raising insults that Geryon had ever heard in his life. Graphic, ugly words passed back and forth between them, almost sizzling in the air. Barak's eyes widened in astonishment, and Mandorallan's face blanched often. Tenedra, her face flaming, bolted out of earshot. The worse the insults, however, the more the hideous Belden smiled. Finally, Aunt Paul delivered an epithet so vile that Geryon actually cringed, and the ugly little man collapsed on the ground, roaring with laughter and hammering at the dirt with his great fists.
"By the gods, I have missed you, Paul," he gasped. "Come here, give us a kiss."
She smiled, kissing his dirty face affectionately.
"Mangy dog."
"You big cow,"
he grinned, catching her in a crushing embrace.
"I'll need my ribs more or less in one piece, Uncle," she told him.
"I haven't cracked any of your ribs in years, my girl."
"Yes, and I'd like to keep it that way."
The twins hurried across to the dwarf Belden, carrying a large plate of steaming stew and a huge tankard. The ugly man looked curiously at the plate, then casually dumped the stew on the ground and tossed the plate away.
"Doesn't smell too bad."
He squatted and began to stuff the food into his mouth with both hands, pausing only now and then to spit out some of the larger pebbles that clung to the chunks of meat. When he had finished, he swilled down the contents of the tankard, belched thunderously, and sat back, scratching at his matted hair with his gravy-smeared fingers.
"Now, let's get down to business."
"Where have you been?" Belgareth asked him.
"Central Tol Murgos. I've been sitting on a hilltop since the Battle of Omimre, watching the cave where Belzedar took Torak."
500 years?
Silk gasped. Belden shrugged.
"Yes, more or less," he replied indifferently. "Somebody had to keep an eye on Burnt Face, and I wasn't doing anything that couldn't be interrupted."
"You said you saw Belzedar?"
"About a month ago. Came to the cave, as if he had a demon on his tail. Pulled Torak out. Then he changed himself into a vulture and flew off with the body."
"It must have been right after Tuchuk caught him at the Nissen border and took the orb away from him,"
Well, I wouldn't know about that. That was part of your responsibility, not mine. All I was supposed to do was keep watch over Tarak. Did any of the ashes fall on you?
Which ashes? One of the twins asked.
When Belzedar took Tarak out of the cave, the mountain exploded, blew its guts out. I imagine it had something to do with the force surrounding old One-Eye's body. It was still blowing when I left.
We wondered what had caused that eruption. It put ash down an inch deep all over Nyssa.
Good. Too bad it wasn't deeper.
Did you see any signs of Tarak stirring?
The twins asked.
Can't you two ever talk straight?
Belden demanded.
We're sorry.
It's our nature.
The ugly little man shook his head with disgust.
Well, never mind. No, Tarak didn't move once in the whole 500 years. There was mold on him when Belzedar dragged him out of that cave.
Did you follow Belzedar?
Well, naturally.
Where did he take Tarak?
Now, where do you think, idiot? To the ruins of Thul Marthrak and Meloria, of course. There are only a few places on Earth that will bear Torak's weight. That's one of them. Belzedar has to keep Torchic and the orb away from Tarak. That's the only place he could go. The Malorian Grolems refuse to accept Tuchik's authority, so Belzedar will be safe there. It will cost him a great deal to pay for their aid. But they'll keep Tuchik out of Meloria, unless he raises an army of Murgos and invades.
There's something we could hope for, Barak said.
You're supposed to be a bear, not a donkey, Belden told him. Don't base your hopes on the impossible. Neither Tuchik nor Belzedar would start that sort of a war at this particular time. Not with Belgarian here stalking through the world like an earthquake.
He scowled at Aunt Paul then.
Can't you teach him to be a little quieter? Or are your wits getting as flabby as your behind?
Be civil, uncle, she replied. The boy is just coming into his strength. We were all a bit clumsy at first.
He doesn't have time to be a baby, Paul. The stars are dropping into southern Thul Murgos like poisoned roaches. Dead Grolems are moaning in their tombs from Rakthul to Rakhaga. Time is on us. He's got to be ready.
He will be ready, uncle.
Maybe,
the filthy old man said sourly.
Are you going back to Thul Mishrak? Belgarath asked.
No. Our master told me to stay here. The twins and I have work to do, and we don't have much time.
He spoke to us, too.
Stop that,
Belden snapped at the twins. He turned back to Belgarath.
Are you going to Rakthul now?
Not yet. We've got to go to Prolgu first. I have to talk to the Gurum. And we've got to pick up another member of the party.
Yes, I noticed that your group was not yet complete. What about the last one?
Belgarath spread his hands.
That's the one that worries me. I have not been able to find any trace of her. And I have been looking for 3,000 years. You spent too much
time looking in alehouses.
I noticed the same thing, uncle,
Aunt Paul said with a sweet little smile.
Where do we go after Prolgu? Barak wanted to know. I think that then we will go to Rakthul, Belgarath replied rather grimly. We have got to get that orb back from Tuchik. And I have been meaning to have a rather pointed discussion with that magician of the Murgos for a long time now.
Part 3. Ulgo. Chapter 13. The following morning, they turned northwest and rode toward the stark white peaks of the mountains of Ulgo, glittering in the morning sun above the lush meadows of the vale.
There's snow up there, Barak observed. It could be a difficult trip.
It always is, Hethar told him.
Have you been to Prolgu before?
Dornick asked.
A few times. We keep communications open with the Ulgos, Our visits there are mostly ceremonial.
Princess Senedra had been riding beside Aunt Paul, her tiny face troubled.
How can you stand him, Lady Bulgara?
She burst out finally.
He's so ugly.
And who is that, dear?
That awful dwarf.
Uncle Belden? Aunt Paul looked mildly surprised. Why, he's always been like that. You have to get to know him, that's all.
But he says such terrible things to you.
It is the way that he hides his real feelings, Aunt Paul explained. He's a very gentle person, really, but people don't expect that coming from him. When he was a child, his people drove him out because he was so deformed and hideous. When he finally came to the Vale, our master saw past that ugliness to the beauty in his mind.
But does he have to be so dirty?
Aunt Paul shrugged slightly.
He hates his deformed body, so he ignores it.
She looked at the princess, her eyes calm.
It is the easiest thing in the world to judge things by appearance, Tenedra, and it is usually wrong. Uncle Belden and I are very fond of each other. That's why we take the trouble to invent such elaborate insults. Compliments would be hypocrisy. He is, after all, very ugly.
I just don't understand,
Tenedra sounded baffled.
Love can show itself in many strange ways, Aunt Paul told her. Her tone was offhand, but the look she directed at the tiny princess was penetrating.
Tenedra flickered one quick look at Geryon, and then averted her eyes, blushing slightly. Geryon considered the exchange between his Aunt Paul and the princess as he rode. It was quite obvious that Aunt Paul had been telling the little girl something important, but whatever it was escaped him. They rode for several days across the Vale, and then moved up into the foothills, which clustered along the flanks of the ragged peaks that formed the land of the Ulgos. Once again the seasons changed as they rode. It was very early autumn as they crested the first low range, and the valleys beyond were aflame with crimson leaves. At the top of a second, higher range, the trees had been swept bare, and the wind had the first bite of winter in it as it whistled down from the peaks. The sky grew overcast, and tendrils of cloud seeped down the rocky gorges above them. Spits of intermittent snow and rain pelted at them as they climbed higher up the rocky slopes.
"I suppose we had better start keeping an eye out for Brill," Silk said hopefully, one snowy afternoon. "It's about time for him to show up again."
"Not very likely," Belgareth replied. "Murgos avoid Ulgoland even more than they avoid the Vale. Ulgos dislike Angarax intensely."
"So do Aelons."
"Ulgos can see in the dark, though," the old man told him. "Murgos who come into these mountains tend not to wake up from their first night's sleep up here. I don't think we need to worry about Brill."
"Pity," Silk murmured with a certain disappointment.
"It won't hurt to keep our eyes open, though. There are worse things than Murgos in the mountains of Ulgo."
Silk scoffed. "Aren't those stories exaggerated?"
"No, not really. The region abounds with monsters, Prince Keldar," Mandorallan assured the little man. "Some years back, a dozen foolish young knights of my acquaintance rode into these mountains to test their bravery and prowess against these unseemly beasts. Not one of them returned."
When they crested the next ridge, the full force of a winter gale struck at them. Snow, which had grown steadily heavier as they climbed, drove horizontally in the howling wind.
"We'll have to take cover until this blows over, Belgarath," Beric shouted above the wind, fighting to keep his flapping bearskin cape around him. "Let's drop down into the next valley," Belgarath replied, also struggling with his cloak. "The trees down there should break this wind."
They crossed the ridge and angled down toward the pines clustered at the bottom of the basin ahead. Geryon pulled his cloak tighter, bowing his head into the shrieking wind. The thick stand of sapling pine in the basin blocked the force of the gale, but the snow swirled about them as they reined in.
"We're not going to get much farther today, Belgorath," Barak declared, trying to brush the snow out of his beard. "We might as well haul up here and wait for the morning."
"What's that?" Dernek asked sharply, cocking his head to one side.
"The winds?" Barak shrugged.
"No. Listen."
Above the howling of the wind, a shrill whinnying sound came to them.
"Look there,"
Hetar pointed. Dimly they saw a dozen horse-like animals crossing the ridge behind them. Their shapes were blurred by the thickly falling snow, and their line, as they moved, seemed almost ghostly. On a rise just above them stood a huge stallion, his mane and tail tossing in the wind. His neigh was almost a shrill scream.
"Hrulgen,"
Belgorath said sharply.
"Can we outrun them?"
Silk asked hopefully.
"I doubt it," Belgorath replied. "Besides, they have got our scent now. They'll dog our trail from here to Prolgu if we try to run. Then we must teach them to fear our trail and to avoid it,"
Mandaraman declared, tightening the straps on his shield. His eyes were very bright.
"You're falling back into your old habits, Mandaraman," Barak observed in a grumpy voice.
Hetar's face had assumed that curiously blank expression it usually did when he was communicating with his horses. He shuddered finally, and his eyes went sick with revulsion.
"Well?"
Aunt Paul asked him.
"They are not horses," he began.
"We know that, Hetar. Can you do anything with them? Frighten them off, perhaps?"
He shook his head.
"They are hungry, Pogora. And they have our scent. The herd stallion seems to have much more control over them than he would if they were horses. I might be able to frighten one or two of the weaker ones, if it were not for him."
"Then we'll have to fight them all,"
Barak said grimly, buckling on his shield.
"I do not think so,"
Hetar replied, his eyes narrowing.
"The key seems to be the stallion. He dominates the whole herd. I think that if we kill him, the rest will turn and run."
"All right," Barak said. "We try for the stallion, then."
"We might want to make some kind of noise,"
Hetar suggested.
"Something that sounds like a challenge. That might make him come out to the front to answer it. Otherwise, we will have to go through the whole herd to get to him."
"Mayhap this will provoke him,"
Mandaraman said. He lifted his horn to his lips and blew a brassy note of ringing defiance that was whipped away by the gale. The stallion's shrill scream answered immediately.
It sounds like it's working," Barak observed. "Blow it again, Mandaraman."
Mandaraman sounded his horn again, and again the stallion shrilled in reply. Then the great beast plunged down from the ridgetop and charged furiously through the herd toward them. When he reached the forefront, he shrieked again and reared up on his hind legs, his front claws flashing in the snowy air.
"That did it," Barak barked. "Let's go."
He jammed his spurs home, and his big gray leaped forward, spraying snow behind him. Hetar and Mandaraman swept out to flank him, and the three plunged forward through the thickly falling snow toward the screaming Hrulga stallion. Mandaraman set his lance as he charged, and a strange sound drifted back on the wind as he thundered toward the advancing Hrulgan. Mandaraman was laughing. Geryon drew his sword and pulled his horse in front of Aunt Paul and Zenedra. He realized that it was probably a futile gesture, but he did it anyway. Two of the Hrulgan, perhaps at the herd stallion's unspoken command, bounded forward to cut off Barak and Mandaraman, while the stallion himself moved to meet Hetar, as if recognizing the Algar as the greatest potential danger to the herd. As the first Hrulga reared, his fangs bared in a cat-like snarl and his clawed feet widespread, Mandaraman lowered his lance and drove it through the snarling monster's chest. Bloody froth burst from the Hrulga's mouth, and he toppled over backward, clawing the broken shaft of Manor Allen's lance into splinters as he fell. Barak caught a clawed swipe on his shield and split open the head of the second Rolga with a vast overhand swing of his heavy sword. The beast collapsed, his convulsions churning the snow. Hetar and the herd stallion stalked each other in the swirling snow. They moved warily, circling. Their eyes locked on each other with a deadly intensity. Suddenly, the stallion reared and lunged all in one motion, his great forelegs wide and his claws outspread. But Hetar's horse, his mind linked with his rider's, danced clear of the furious charge. The Hroga spun and charged again, and once again Hetar's horse jumped to the side. The infuriated stallion screamed his frustration and lunged in, his claws flailing. Hetar's horse sidestepped this enraged beast, then darted in, and Hetar launched himself from his saddle and landed on the stallion's back. His long, powerful legs locked about the Hroga's ribs, and his right hand gathered a great fistful of the animal's mane. The stallion went mad as he felt for the first time in the entire history of his species the weight of a rider on his back. He plunged and reared and shrieked, trying to shake Hetar off. The rest of the herd, which had been moving to the attack, faltered and stared in uncomprehending horror at the stallion's wild attempts to dislodge his rider. Manor Allen and Barak reined in, dumbfounded, as Hetar rode the raging stallion in circles through the blizzard. Then, grimly, Hetar slid his left hand down his leg and drew a long, broad dagger from his boot. He knew horses, and he knew where to strike. His first thrust was lethal. The churned snow turned red. The stallion reared one last time, screaming and with blood pouring out of his mouth, and then he dropped back to stand on shuddering legs. Slowly his knees buckled and he toppled to one side. Hetar jumped clear. The herd of the Hrolgan turned and fled, squealing, back into the blizzard. Hetar grimly cleaned his dagger in the snow and resheathed it in his boot. Briefly he had laid one hand on the dead stallion's neck, then turned to look through the trampled snow for the saber he had discarded in his wild leap onto the stallion's back. When the three warriors returned to the shelter of the trees, Manor Allen and Barak were staring at Hetar with a look of profound respect.
"It is a shame that they are mad," the Algar said, with a distant look on his face. "There was a moment, just a moment, when I almost got through to him, and we moved together. Then the madness came back, and I had to kill him. If they could be tamed..."
He broke off and shook his head.
"Oh, well,"
he shrugged regretfully.
"You wouldn't actually ride something like that."
Durnick's voice was shocked.
"I have never had an animal like that under me,"
Hetar said quietly.
"I do not think that I will ever forget what it is like."
The tall man turned and walked some distance away, and he stood staring out into the swirling snow. They set up for the night in the shelter of the pines. The next morning the wind had abated, although it was still snowing heavily, when they set out again. The snow was already knee-deep, and the horses struggled as they climbed. They crossed yet another ridge and started down into the next valley. Silk looked dubiously around at the thickly falling snow settling through the silent air.
"If it gets much deeper, we're going to bog down, Belgarath," he said glumly. "Particularly if we have to keep climbing like this."
"We will be all right now," the old man assured him. "We follow a series of valleys from here. They lead right up to Prolgo, so we can avoid the peaks."
"Belgarath," Beric said back over his shoulder from his place in the lead, "there are some fresh tracks up here."
He pointed ahead at a line of footprints plowed through the new snow across their path. The old man moved ahead and stopped to examine the tracks.
"Algroth," he said shortly, "we had better keep our eyes open."
They rode warily down into the valley where Manor Allen paused long enough to cut himself a fresh lance.
I'd be a little dubious about a weapon that keeps breaking, Barak observed as the knight remounted.
Mandaraman shrugged, his armor creaking.
There are always trees around, my lord, he replied.
Back among the pines that carpeted the valley floor, Garion heard a familiar barking.
Grandfather,
he warned.
I hear them, Belgarath answered.
How many do you think? Silk asked.
Perhaps a dozen.
Eight, Aunt Paul corrected firmly.
If they are but eight, will they dare attack? Mandaraman asked. Those we met in Arindia seem to seek courage in numbers. Their lair is in this valley, I think, the old man replied. Any animal tries to defend its lair. They are almost certain to attack. We must seek them out, then, the knight declared confidently. Better to destroy them now on ground of our own choosing, than to be surprised in some ambush.
He is definitely backsliding, Barak observed sourly to Etar.
And he is probably right this time, Etar replied.
Have you been drinking, Etar? Barak asked suspiciously. Come, my lords, Mandaraman said gaily. Let us rout these brutes so that we may continue our journey unmolested.
He plowed off through the snow in search of the barking Algroths.
You coming, Barak?
Etar invited as he drew his saber.
Barak sighed. I guess I'd better, he answered mournfully.
He turned to Belgarath.
This shouldn't take long. I will try to keep our bloodthirsty friends out of trouble.
Etar laughed.
You are getting to be as bad as he is,
Barak accused, as the two of them moved into a gallop alongside of Mandaraman. Garion and the others sat waiting tensely in the sifting snowfall. Then the barking sounds off in the woods suddenly turned into yelps of surprise. The sound of blows began to ring through the trees, and there were shrieks of pain and shouts as the three warriors called to each other. After perhaps a quarter of an hour, they came galloping back with the deep snow spraying out from their horses' hooves.
Two of them got away,
Etar reported regretfully.
What a shame, Silk replied.
Mandaraman, Barak said with a pained look. You have picked up a bad habit somewhere. Fighting is a serious business, and all of this giggling and laughing of yours is smacks of frivolity.
Doth it offend thee, my lord?
It's not so much that it offends me, Mandaraman. It is more a distraction. It breaks my concentration.
I shall strive to moderate my laughter in the future, then.
Well, I would appreciate it.
How did it go? Silk asked.
It wasn't much of a fight. We caught them completely by surprise. I hate to admit it, but our tortling friend there was right for once.
Garion thought about Mandaraman's changed behavior as they rode on down into the valley. Back at the cave, where the colt had been born, Durnak had told Mandaraman that fear could be conquered by laughing at it, and though Durnak had probably not meant it in precisely that way, Mandaraman had taken his words quite literally. The laughter which so irritated Barak was not directed at the foe that he met, but rather at the enemy within. Mandaraman was laughing at his own fear as he rode to each attack.
It's unnatural, Barak was muttering to Silk. That's what bothers me so much. Not only that, it's a breach of etiquette. If we ever get into a serious fight, it's going to be terribly embarrassing to have him giggling and carrying on like that. What will the people think?
You're making too much of it, Barak, Silk told him.
Actually, I think it's rather refreshing.
You think it's what?
Refreshing. An errand with a sense of humor is a novelty, after all. Sort of like a talking dog.
Barak shook his head with disgust. There's absolutely no point in ever trying to discuss anything seriously with you. Did you know that, Silk? This compulsion of yours to make clever remarks turns everything into a joke.
Oh, we all have our little shortcomings, Silk admitted blandly.
Chapter 14. The snow gradually slackened throughout the rest of the day, and by evening, only a few solitary flakes drifted down through the darkening air as they set up for the night in a grove of dense spruces. During the night, however, the temperature fell, and the air was bitterly cold when they arose the next morning.
"How much farther to Progu?"
Silk asked, standing close to the fire with his shivering hands stretched out to its warmth.
2 more days, Belgarath replied.
"I don't suppose that you would consider doing something about the weather," the little man asked hopefully.
"I prefer not to do that, unless I absolutely have to," the old man told him. "It disrupts things over a very wide area. Besides, the Gorim doesn't like us to tamper with things in his mountains. The Ulgos have reservations about that sort of thing."
"I was afraid that you might look at it that way."
Their route that morning twisted and turned so often that by noon Geryon was completely turned around. Despite the biting cold, the sky was overcast, a solid lead gray. It seemed somehow as if the cold had frozen all color from the world. The sky was gray, the snow was a flat, dead white, and the tree trunks were starkly black. Even the rushing water in the streams they followed flowed black between snow-mounded banks. Belgarath moved confidently, pointing their direction as each succeeding valley intersected with another.
"Are you sure?" the shivering Silk asked him at one point. "We've been going upstream all day, and now you say we go down."
"We'll hit another valley in a few miles. Trust me, Silk. I have been here before."
Silk pulled his heavy cloak tighter.
"It's just that I get nervous on unfamiliar ground," he objected,
looking at the dark water of the river that they were following. From far upstream came a strange sound, a kind of mindless hooting that was almost like laughter. Aunt Paul and Belgarath exchanged a quick look.
"What is it?"
Geryon asked.
"Rock wolf,"
Belgarath answered shortly.
"It doesn't sound like a wolf."
"It isn't."
The old man looked around warily.
"They're scavengers for the most part, and if it's just a wild pack, they probably won't attack. It is too early in the winter for them to be that desperate. If it is one of the packs that has been raised by the Eldrakhen, though, well, then we are in for trouble."
He stood up in his stirrups to look ahead.
"Let's pick up the pace a bit," he called to Mandarallan. "Keep your eyes open."
Mandarallan, his armor glittering with frost, glanced back, nodded, and moved out at a trot, following the seething black water of the mountain river. Behind them, the shrill, yelping laughter grew louder.
"They're following us, father,"
Aunt Paul said.
"I can hear that."
The old man began searching the sides of the valley with his eyes, his face creased with a worried frown.
"You'd better have a look, Paul. I do not want any surprises."
Aunt Paul's eyes grew distant as she probed the thickly forested sides of the valley with her mind. After a moment, she gasped and then shuddered.
"There's an Eldrak out there, father. He's watching us. His mind is a sewer."
"They always are," the old man replied. "Could you pick up his name?"
"Grull."
"Yeah, that's what I was afraid of. I knew we were getting close to his range."
He put his fingers to his lips and whistled sharply. Barak and Mandarallan halted to wait while the rest caught up with them.
"We've got trouble," Belgarath told them all seriously. "There's an Eldrak out there with a pack of rock wolves. He is watching us right now. It's only a question of time until he attacks."
"What is an Eldrak?" Silk asked.
"The Eldrakin are related to Algroths and trolls, but they are more intelligent and much bigger." "But only one?"
Mandarallan asked.
"One is enough. I have met this one. His name is Grull. He's big, quick, and as cruel as a hook-pointed knife.
He will eat anything that moves, and he does not really care if it is dead or not before he starts to eat it.
The hooting laughter of the rock wolves drew closer.
Let's find an open place and build a fire, the old man said. The rock wolves are afraid of fire, and there is no point in fighting them and Groll if we don't have to. There, Durnick suggested, pointing to a broad, snow-covered bar protruding out into the dark water of the river.
The bar was joined to the near bank by a narrow neck of gravel and sand.
It's defensible, Valgarath, Beric approved, squinting at the bar. The river will keep them off of our backs, and they can only come at us across that one narrow place. It will do, Belgareth agreed shortly. Let's go.
They rode out onto the snow-covered bar, and quickly scraped an area clear with their feet, while Durnick worked to build a fire under a large gray driftwood snag that half-blocked the narrow neck of the bar. Within a few moments, orange flames began to lick up around the snag. Durnick fed the fire with sticks until the snag was fully ablaze.
Give me a hand,
the smith said, starting to pile larger pieces of wood onto the fire. Barak and Mandaralan went to the jumbled mass of driftwood piled against the upstream edge of the gravel and began hauling limbs and chunks of log to the fire. At the end of a quarter of an hour, they had built a roaring bonfire that stretched across the narrow neck of sand, cutting them off completely from the dark trees on the riverbank.
That is the first time that I have been warm all day, Silk grinned, backing up to the fire.
They're coming,
Geryon warned. Back among the dark tree trunks, he had caught a few glimpses of furtive movement.
Barak peered through the flames. Big brutes, aren't they?
He observed grimly.
About the size of a donkey,
Belgarath confirmed.
Are you sure that they are afraid of fire? Silk asked nervously.
Most of the time.
Most of the time?
Once in a while they get desperate. Or Groll could drive them toward us. They would be more afraid of him than of the fire.
Belgarath, the weasel-faced little man objected. Sometimes you have got a nasty habit of keeping things to yourself.
One of the rock wolves came out onto the riverbank, just upstream from the bar, and stood sniffing at the air, looking nervously toward the fire. Its forelegs were noticeably longer than its hind ones, giving it a peculiar half-erect stance, and there was a large, muscular hump across its shoulders. Its muzzle was short, and it seemed snub-faced, almost like a cat. Its coat was splotchy, black and white, marked with a pattern hovering somewhere between spots and stripes. It paced nervously back and forth, staring at them with a dreadful intensity, and yelping its high-pitched, hooting laugh. Soon, another came out to join it, and then another. They spread out along the bank, pacing and hooting, but staying well back from the fire.
They don't look like dogs, exactly, Durnick said. They're not, Belgareth replied. Wolves and dogs are related, but rock wolves belong in a different family.
By now, 10 of the ugly creatures lined the bank, and their hooting rose in a mindless chorus. Then, Tenedra screamed, her face deathly pale and her eyes wide with horror. The Eldrak shambled out of the trees and stood in the middle of the yelping pack. It was about 8 feet tall, covered with shaggy black fur. It wore an armored shirt that had been made of large scraps of chain mail tied together with thongs. Over the mail, also held in place with leather thongs, was a rusty breastplate that appeared to have been hammered out with rocks until it was big enough to fit around the creature's massive chest. A conical steel helmet, split up the back to make it fit, covered the brute's head. In its hand, the Eldrek held a huge, steel-wrapped club, studded with spikes. It was the face, however, that had brought the scream to Tenedra's lips. The Eldrek had virtually no nose, and its lower jaw jutted, showing two massive, protruding tusks. Its eyes were sunk in deep sockets beneath a heavy ridge of bone across its brow, and they burned with a hideous hunger.
That's far enough, Groll, Belgarath warned the thing in a cold, deadly voice.
Grat, come back to Grull's Mountain,
the monster growled. Its voice was deep, hollow, and chilling.
It talks, Silk gasped incredulously.
Why are you following us, Grull?
Belgareth demanded. The creature stared at them, its eyes like fire.
Hungry, Grot,
it growled.
Go hunt something else,
the old man told the monster.
Why?
Horses.
Here. Men.
Plenty to eat. But not easy food, Grull.
A hideous grin spread across Grull's face.
Fight first, then eat. Come, Grat, fight again.
Grat, Silk asked.
He means me. He cannot pronounce my name. It has to do with the shape of his jaw.
You fought that thing?
Barak sounded stunned. Belgareth shrugged.
I had a knife up my sleeve. When he grabbed me, I sliced him open. Wasn't much of a fight.
Fight!
Grull roared. He hammered on his breastplate with his huge fist.
Iron,
he said.
Come, Krat. Try cut Grull's bed again. Now, Grull, wear iron like men wear.
He began to pound on the frozen ground with his steel-shod club.
Fight!
He bellowed.
Come, Grat, fight!
Maybe if we all go after him at once, one of us might get in a lucky thrust,
Brack said, eyeing the monster speculatively.
Thy plan is flawed, my lord. We must lose several companions should we come within range of that club.
Barak looked at him in astonishment.
Prudence, Mandarallan? Prudence? From you?
It were best, I think, should I undertake this alone. My lance is the only weapon that can seek out the monster's life with any safety,
the knight stated gravely.
There is something to what he says, Hetar agreed.
Come, fight!
Grull roared again, still beating on the ground with his club.
All right, Barak agreed dubiously. We will distract him, then. Come at him from two sides to get his attention. Then Mandarallan can make his charge.
What about the rock wolves?
Garion asked.
Let me try something, Dernick said.
He took up a burning stick and threw it, spinning and flaring at the nervous pack surrounding the monster. The rock wolves yelped and shied quickly away from the tumbling brand.
Ah, they're afraid of the fire, all right, the smith said. I think that if we all throw at once and keep throwing, then their nerve will break and they'll all run.
They moved toward the fire.
Now!
Dernick shouted sharply. They began throwing the blazing sticks as fast as they could. The rock wolves yelped and dodged, and several of them screamed in pain as the tumbling firebrands singed them. Grull roared in fury as the pack dodged and scurried around his feet, trying to escape the sudden deluge of fire. One of the singed beasts, maddened by pain and fright, tried to leap at him. The Eldrek jumped out of its way with astonishing agility and smashed the rock wolf to the ground with his great club.
Ugh. He's quicker than I thought, Barak said. We'll have to be careful.
Ah, they're running,
Dernick shouted, throwing another fiery stick. The pack had broken under the rain of burning brands and turned to flee, howling, back into the woods, leaving the infuriated Grull standing alone on the riverbank, hammering at the snow-covered ground with his spiked club.
Come fight! Come fight!
He roared again and again. He advanced one huge step and smashed his club at the snow again.
"We'd better do whatever we're going to do now," Silk said tensely. "He's getting himself worked up. We'll have him out here on the bar with us in another minute or two."
Mandarallan nodded grimly and turned to mount his charger.
"Let the rest of us distract him first," Barak said.
He drew his heavy sword.
"Let's go!"
he shouted, and leaped over the fire. The others followed him, spreading out in a half-circle in front of the towering Grull. Garion reached for his sword.
Not you,
Aunt Paul snapped. You stay here.
But do as I say.
One of Silk's daggers, skillfully thrown from several yards away, sank into Grohl's shoulder while the creature was advancing on Barak and Durnik. Grohl howled and turned to charge Silk and Hedhar, swinging his vast club. Hedhar dodged, and Silk danced back out of reach. Durnik began pelting the monster with fist-sized rocks from the riverbank. Grohl turned back, raging now, with flecks of foam dripping from his pointed tusks.
Now, Mandorallan!
Mandorallan couched his lance and spurred his warhorse. The huge armored animal leaped forward, its hooves churning gravel, jumped the fire, and bore down on the astonished Grohl. For a moment it looked as if their plan might work. The deadly steel-pointed lance was leveled at Grohl's chest, and it seemed that nothing could stop it from plunging through his huge body. But the monster's quickness again astonished them all. He leaped to one side and smashed his spiked club down on Mandorallan's lance, shattering the stout wood. The force of Mandorallan's charge, however, could not be stopped. Horse and man crashed into the great brute with a deafening impact. Grohl reeled back, dropping his club, tripping, falling with Mandorallan and his warhorse on top of him.
"Get him!"
Barak roared, and they all dashed forward to attack the fallen Grohl with swords and axes. The monster, however, levered his legs under Mandorallan's thrashing horse and thrust the big animal off. A great, flailing fist caught Mandorallan in the side, throwing him for several yards. Durnik spun and dropped, felled by a glancing blow to the head, even as Barak, Hetar, and Silk swarmed over the fallen Grohl.
"Father!"
Aunt Paul cried in a ringing voice. There was suddenly a new sound directly behind Garion. First a deep, rumbling snarl, followed instantly by a hair-raising howl. Garion turned quickly and saw the huge wolf he had seen once before in the forests of northern Arindia. The old gray wolf bounded across the fire and entered the fight, his great teeth flashing and tearing.
"Garion, I need you!"
Aunt Paul was shaking off the panic-stricken princess and pulling her amulet out of her bodice.
"Take out your medallion, quickly!"
He did not understand, but he drew his amulet out from under his tunic. Aunt Paul reached out, took his right hand, and placed the mark on his palm against the figure of the owl on her own talisman. At the same time, she took out his medallion in her other hand.
"Focus your will," she commanded.
"On what?"
"On the amulets, quickly!"
Garion brought his will to bear, feeling the power building in him tremendously, amplified somehow by his contact with Aunt Paul and the two amulets. Talgara closed her eyes and raised her face to the leaden sky.
"Mother!"
she cried in a voice so loud that the echo rang like a trumpet note in the narrow valley. The power surged out of Garion in so vast a rush that he collapsed to his knees, unable to stand. Aunt Paul sank down beside him. Tenedra gasped. As Garion weakly raised his head, he saw that there were two wolves attacking the raging Grohl. The gray old wolf he knew to be his grandfather, and another, slightly smaller wolf, that seemed surrounded by a strange, flickering blue light. Grohl had struggled to his feet and was laying about him with his huge fists as the men attacking him chopped futilely at his armored body. Barak was flung out of the fight and fell to his hands and knees, shaking his head groggily. Grohl brushed Hetar aside, his eyes alight with a dreadful glee, as he lunged toward Barak with both huge arms raised. But the blue wolf leaped snarling at his face. Grohl swung his fist and gaped with astonishment as it passed directly through the flickering body. Then he shrieked with pain and began to topple backward as Belgarath, darting in from behind to employ the wolf's ancient tactic, neatly hamstrung him with great ripping teeth. The towering Grohl, howling, fell and struck the earth like some vast tree.
"Keep him down!"
Barak roared, stumbling to his feet and staggering forward. The wolves were ripping at Grohl's face, and he flailed his arms, trying to beat them away. Again and again his hands passed through the body of the strange, flickering blue wolf. Mandorallan, his feet spread wide apart, holding the hilt of his broadsword with both hands, chopped steadily at the monster's body, his great blade shearing long rents in Grohl's breastplate. Brock swung huge blows at Grohl's head, his sword striking sparks from the rusty steel helmet. Hetar crouched at one side, eyes intent, saber ready, waiting. Grohl raised his arm to ward off Barak's blows, and Hetar lunged, thrusting his saber through the exposed armpit and into the huge chest. A bloody froth spouted from Grohl's mouth as the saber ripped through his lungs. He struggled to a half-sitting position. Then, Silk, who had lurked just at the edge of the fight, darted in, set the point of his dagger against the back of Grohl's neck, and smashed a large rock against the dagger's pommel. With a sickening crunch, the dagger drove through bone, angling up into the monster's brain. Grohl shuddered convulsively, then collapsed. In the moment of silence that followed, the two wolves looked at each other across the monster's dead face. The blue wolf seemed to wink once. In a voice which Geryon could hear quite clearly, a woman's voice, she said,
"How remarkable."
With a seeming smile and one last flicker, she vanished. The old gray wolf raised his muzzle and howled, a sound of such piercing anguish and loss that Geryon's heart wrenched within him. Then, the old wolf seemed to shimmer, and Belgareth knelt in his place. He rose slowly to his feet and walked back toward the fire, tears streaming openly down his grizzled cheeks. Chapter 15.
"Is he going to be all right?" Barak asked anxiously, hovering over the still unconscious Durnik, as Aunt Paul examined the large purple contusion on the side of the smith's face.
"It's nothing serious,"
she replied in a voice seeming to droop with great weariness. Geryon sat nearby with his head in his hands. He felt as if all of the strength had been wrenched out of his body. Beyond the heaped coals of the rapidly dying bonfire, Silk and Hetar were struggling to remove Mandaralan's dented breastplate. A deep crease, running diagonally from shoulder to hip, gave mute evidence of the force of Grohl's blow, and placed so much stress on the straps beneath the shoulder plates that they were almost impossible to unfasten.
"I think we're going to have to cut them," Silk said.
"I pray thee, Prince Keldar, avoid that if possible,"
Mandaralan answered, quincing as they wrenched at the fastenings.
"Those straps are crucial to the fit of the armor, and are the most difficult to replace properly." "This one is coming now,"
Hetar grunted, prying at a buckle with a short iron rod. The buckle released suddenly, and the taut breastplate rang like a softly struck bell.
"Now I can get it,"
Silk said, quickly loosening the other shoulder buckle. Mandaralan sighed with relief as they pulled off the dented breastplate. He took a deep breath and winced again.
"Tender, right here?"
Silk asked, putting his fingers lightly to the right side of the knight's chest. Mandaralan grunted with pain, and his face paled visibly.
"I think that you have got some cracked ribs, my splendid friend,"
Silk told him.
"You'd better have Palgra take a look."
"In a moment," Mandaralan said. "My horse?"
"He will be all right,"
Hetar replied.
"A strained tendon in his right foreleg is all."
Mandaralan let out a sigh of relief.
"I had feared for him."
"I feared for us all there for a while," Silk said. "Our oversized playmate there was almost more than we could handle."
"It was a good fight, though," Hetar remarked.
Silk gave him a disgusted look, then glanced up at the scudding gray clouds overhead. He jumped across the glowing coals of their fire, and went over to where Belgarath sat staring in the icy river.
"We are going to have to get off of this bar, Belgarath," he urged. "The weather's going bad on us again, and we will all freeze to death if we stay out here in the middle of the river tonight."
"Leave me alone,"
Belgarath muttered shortly, still staring at the river.
"Palgra?"
Silk turned to her.
just stay away from him for a while. Go find a sheltered place for us to stay for a few days.